I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Thank you all very much for coming. It's really good to see you all. Thanks for coming out on a cold night. I'm not surprised you're here, though, because the book sounds amazing, and it's amazing to have Derek Owusu here to talk about Losing the Plot, published by Canongate Books. Derek's going to be in conversation with Jason Ogundaye, whose book we would have on the table, except it's not published till 2024. Revolutionary Acts, which we're also really looking forward to. Thank you both very much for being here. And please welcome our guests. Thank you both so much.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to today's event. We're chatting to the fabulous Derek about his new book, Losing the Plot, which is getting rave reviews, which we're going to get into. So how are you today, Derek?
I'm good, actually. Yeah, so, I've been nervous about this event. Yeah.
So today, a couple hours ago, Derek tweeted, like, I feel like, you know, for these interviews, he wants people to ask about the body and the gym. let's not go into that. But this book, Losing the Plot. So honestly, not to kind of just like blow smoke up your ass, but it's incredibly beautiful and it's incredibly moving. But what is really notable about it is the structure. The structure is incredibly unique. So the way that it's composed is that there's a body of text which represents the mother in the story, and then there are marginal notes as well from the mother's son, kind of like narrating and translating and commentating on the mother. So what was the kind of like inspiration behind this format, and how did this format come to you? Did the book have different forms before it took this structure?
Yeah, so essentially when I wrote the book, as I always start most of my books, as kind of like a series of poems, kind of like poetry. The son was in the main narrative, intertwined in the main narrative. And then, you know, I kind of started thinking, because of what I was trying to do, trying to really kind of, you know, get people to pay attention to the narrative, the mother's narrative, her story. This is about her, and the son is just basically there as part of her story. I decided to kind of move the son to kind of the footnotes at the bottom of the page. And that was also basically, there's a lot of untranslated tree in the book. So there's like words, there's some longer phrases. And I also didn't want a glossary in the book. I just felt like, from my experience of reading books where there's a glossary of the words, people would keep having to go and check what the word means and then go back and all those kind of things. And I just felt like it took people out of the narrative too much. So I didn't want that. I didn't want to translate it. But I also just wanted to kind of to be like, just you have to try and figure out what the words mean, because that is a lot of our experiences, you know, my generation and your generation with immigrant mothers who didn't want to teach us their mother tongue. We had to kind of listen to them speaking and get the context of the words. Or when they're insulting us, try and get the context of the insults and then figure out what it means. So I wanted to give the reader that exact experience as well. But obviously, when the son does come in speaking in the footnotes, there would be a translation of the word within what he's saying, and the reader would just obviously have to try and figure it out. And then when I was having a conversation with my editor, she was kind of like, you know what, Derek, if you're going to do this experimental thing, just go all the way. Like, just having footnotes there, it's not enough. So she was just like, move the son into the margins, which made perfect sense, because what I was trying to do was essentially marginalize the son anyway. So that would be, you know, a visual representation of marginalizing the son the children and focusing on the mother's story. As mothers tend to marginalize themselves and put their children's story before them, this was another way to do that and put her first. And it just kind of worked. It just worked in that way. And, you know, a lot of people ask me when I do events, and I'm sure some people ask me to kind of like, should I read the main text first and then read the margin or whatever? But it's up to you, however you want to read it. Do you know what I mean? You can read the main body of the text first and then go back and read, or read them at the same time. It's up to you. You know, I just really tried to create an we were trying to create an experience with the experimental style.
I think it's interesting you talk about the kind of like difficulty in understanding your parents, but the fact that you kind of work from context. In a similar way, the way in which the man in the margins, Akwasi, mm-hmm. Speaks and writes, there's a certain kind of like working class black vernacular there, which for some audiences would possibly need that translated. But also it's not necessarily like the language that you speak to. So where did you source the language for Akwasi in writing that? Did you have conversations with people to try and establish that, or did that come from any kind of familial or friendship influence?
Yeah, the choice of, I guess, the voice for the son was, it kind of just, it felt natural that had to be the voice. That's one thing. And when you're writing fiction, sometimes you have no idea where these ideas come from. They just come somewhere and they just work, or they don't. And this just, it felt like this would work. I keep saying this as well, that when it comes to, I guess, kind of like working class black vernacular or whatever, when you're a black person or when you're working class, you just think to yourself, I can write this, it's going to be so easy. I know how to write slang. I've been around this my whole life. Do you know what I mean? But it was incredibly hard. You know, it was really, really difficult to do. I was writing it and reading it back and then reading it out loud. And it's just kind of like, there's just something not right about this. So I had to really work at it to try and get the rhythm and the cadences and everything in the right place so that it sounded right. Because, you know, I think a lot of people, when they read as well, they don't realize that they're reading bad slang in novels. Black British, they don't realize they're reading it, that it's terrible. Like, for example, people assume that guys who grew up in, and it's even like roadmen, speak how they speak in like Top Boy or Kiddohood, but no one speaks like that all the time. Do you know what I mean? When we code switch, it's not just when we're speaking to people outside of our experience. When we're speaking to each other as well, you know, you'll be talking to someone and their English would, you know, become more slangy and then become almost more formal, and then they'll kind of drop a word that they heard somewhere and they want to try and show off with that word. Do you know what I mean? So many different ways of speaking, and that's what I was really trying to recreate, not create a caricature of, you know, of working class black English. And that was, yeah, it was very, very, it was really hard to do. But luckily I had my brother around. And another thing that was hard is that you have to decide what kind of black English do you want to use here? Because I couldn't use words like pattern, because I just don't know what that means realistically. Do you know what I mean? Or words like peng or chung. So I had to think to myself, what genre of black English am I trying to use here? Do you know what I mean? There was a lot of thought that had to go into it. But yeah, luckily I did have my brother around, and he, not in terms of the words, but the way he spoke, the rhythm, you know, when they're speaking, it's like there's a proper rhythm to it. You know what I mean? I could pick that up from him and, you know, listen to him, and I would say, read stuff out to him, and he'll just be like, nah, Derek, something not right about this. And I'll change one word and he'll be like, yeah, that's how we'd say it. Do you know what I mean? So that was really helpful.
And I think that's interesting, because when people escape this book, particularly if they know who you are, they might make the assumption that the man in the margins is just you, and that's how you speak, and it's coming from your internal.
Yeah.
And something you've been keen to emphasize is that this is a book, this is a work of fiction.
Yeah.
Even though perhaps it's been prompted by thoughts and conversations you've had about, you know, your mother and of migration and of Ghanaian heritage, it is a work of fiction. And so what kind of placeholders from your own life did you take and then build from using imagination? And did you specifically try to limit how much of, you know, how much it resembled perhaps yourself and your mother or your family?
I didn't need to try, because I don't know anything about my mother or, you know, my family too much. You know, with the voice in the margins, I'm trying to think, was there anything that I thought, this has happened and I could fictionalize it? I don't think so. No, I just kind of, well, I guess general things like prayer, like praying, you know, you know, Pentecostal style of praying, where kind of like in the middle of the night, you're up and you're like uppercutting the devil and doing all this kind of stuff, fighting, and that kind of enthusiastic prayer, that kind of thing. And just general things that we all know. You know, you're about to go to, like, on a night out, your mum's in the kitchen cooking with Bear Maggie and spices and stuff, and you don't want the food to go in your clothes, so you wait to the last minute, and then you run out the front door. Do you know what I mean? Those kind of things that we've all experienced, that's there, but that's not mine. That's not something that's mine. So the main narrative, all of it is complete fiction. And I feel complimented when someone says, no, this has to be a memoir, because it means that they're really feeling like these characters are real and there's something about them that is really connecting with them. Because I've read many memoirs and I've read reviews of memoirs where people are just kind of like, this just feels, you know, too made up. Do you know what I mean? They're not even connecting with a real story. So if people connect with mine and thinking it is, I'll take that.
I mean, there's a kind of authenticity in the fiction which makes it very real. But I also think that it's a very rare example of a kind of like Afropolitan working class experience of, you know, someone who is like, comes to this country. And I think that the parallels you can make would be, say, for example, the Lonely Londoners and the kind of fictionalization of working class Caribbean migrants in this country and the kind of working conditions that they faced. But I wonder, though this book is fiction, could we also consider this book a kind of historical record? So you're saying that, you know, you spoke to some experiences which you felt were universal for children of migrants, and in lieu of us being able to actually speak to our parents, is there something that you're trying to capture and like a time to create a kind of like record of, you know, this time and these kind of intergenerational relations for people in the future?
Yeah, I think this the difficulty and the resistance in trying to get to the past. I think Black British people, there's such contradiction in what we're trying to do or what we think we're supposed to do. You know, the cliche that, you know, you don't know where you're going until you know where you've been. You have to learn from the past and all these kind of things. But a lot of our past and history, individual family histories, are blocks to us. We can't access them because our parents won't give us that information. A lot of us, you know, you want to know, you know, people always talk about generational curses and all of these kind of things. But they don't really know the details of what's happened in the family life before they were born. And that is, from what I've read as well, often a uniquely Black British thing. Do you know what I mean? Well, no, an immigrant thing. So I think, yeah, people reading in the future, I hope that they're able to, the essence of that conflict is there. And the struggle that we faced in trying to reach for an identity and not being able to do that, so having to then create our own art, in a sense, do you know what I mean, out of that conflict that happens. But also know that it's always coming from a place of love, do you know what I mean? You know, when we ask our parents questions and we want to know things about their past, it's always coming from a place of love. It's never, we're just trying to be nosy and whatnot, you know? And I hope that comes across in the voice in the margins in the book, that, you know, as he's almost reading the book along with us, because he wants to get to know his mum a bit more. But he's also adding anecdotes. He's adding spices to the stories. By the end, you realize, I have a relationship with my mum. Even though I don't actually know who she was before me, that doesn't take away from the actual real life connection that I have with her.
I think that resistance that you get with West African mothers in particular is quite interesting, because I find that West Africans are some of the most natural storytellers as well. It's subject on tradition. So I remember when I was younger, my mother would tell me all of these kind of like folk stories about like the tortoise and things like that. And if you can get them in the right mood for gist, they will go off. You know, they will probably like start narrating like such gossip. So
until they catch themselves.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly, yeah. Exactly that. So what do you think it is that sets up such a barrier? And also, do you think it's a specific West African issue? Because sometimes, you know, I look at the record that Caribbean people have of their elders and I think it's a lot stronger. Even say the book Homecoming by Colin Grant, where you just have like a number of Caribbean migrants, you know, speaking about their life experiences and talking about even the smallest details that we possibly just can't get out of our parents, whether it's, you know, where did you work and how long did you work there for?
Yeah,
do you think
it's
a specific West African issue?
I think now it seems to be specifically West African. I think that it's about being comfortable in the country that you're now trying to set up shop in. But of course, you know, my friend Simeon Brown, we joke about this all the time, you know, that he says that the only time you really find out what your uncle's real name was at his funeral. Because with Jamaicans, they're always using a false name. You'll never know what their real name is. And I think with kind of like the Windrush generation and so on, they got to a point where they may have felt comfortable in the UK, and then they can kind of share their histories and stuff because they feel like this is our country. My mum doesn't feel like this is her country. She lives here and she feels like she's British, but my mum, my aunties, they don't really feel like this is their country yet. Whereas I do in a certain way, do you know what I mean? And I think that's what it is. So there's a really brilliant essay in IC3 where there's a professor who basically comes to the same conclusion that I've come to, that, you know, there's not enough literature on the West African experience. And so she's trying to collate these stories and put them into a book. And all of the people that approach her are just resistant. No one wants to talk about it. Some of them are even attacking her, calling her house, saying, why are you trying to probe into our lives and blah, blah, blah. It's because there's still a kind of a fear that they might be kicked out of the country. That's one. But then there's also that we've come here to start fresh. Why do you want to go into the past? Why do you want to do that? You know, like I always say that when when West Africans, especially, talk about you must know your history, you know, they're talking about collective history. They're not talking about individual history. If you ask about your life, that's not important. The struggle, yeah, that's important. What we all went through, not what me individually went through. Do you know what I mean?
I think that's a real difference between, you know, that generation and our generation as well, because our generation are oversharers. Mm-hmm. So where my mother is horrified by my Twitter. Horrified.
Yeah,
she's can you...
My mum too.
You know, I remember there was a video that came out recently and it was of these like young kids. They were kind of hotting up their African dad for having an affair. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, oh my God, the inside of your living room. So all of these people, I was just there thinking to my mom, even if I put a picture, even if I put a photo that shows a bit of the living room, that shows a bit of bedroom, it's like, why are you showing all these people where you live? They can figure that out.
Yeah.
And do you almost feel like our generation has kind of like subverted that? Because I almost sometimes think that the reason why I'm such an oversharer is because my mother is not, and I almost feel like free to be able to say like this and that, and talk about my life experience and things that have happened.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. I think a lot of our generation are overshares. One, obviously, because there is social media. But though I do believe if social media was around when my mum was young as well, she still wouldn't be oversharing. Do you know what I mean? But yeah, social media plays a part. But also, like I said, the fact that our generation, our identity is so shaky, we use the oversharing for people to say, me too. And then we can connect with them. Do you know what I mean? And then through that, then try and build a community. Do you know what I mean? Because I feel like that's what a lot of, because when you, especially on social media, that's what oversharing realistically is about. When someone likes a tweet, they're saying, yeah, me too, or that's funny, or that's connection. When someone retweets, that's connection. Do you know what I mean? And I feel like, yeah, that's what it is. I think that's what it is. But it's interesting you say that, yeah, because, you know, obviously, my mum's never seen my Twitter. I don't think my mum really understands what Twitter is. But when I do like these events and I'll say to my mum, yeah, so I said this to the audience, and she'll be like, why are you telling all of these people your business, blah, blah, blah. Do you know what I mean? So I think people should also take that in mind as well, to think that this is how my mum is. It would be absolutely impossible for me to write about her real life in a book because she would just not talk to me ever again. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And this is what I wanted to get onto as well. So there's the main body of the book, and then there's an epilogue, which shows Akwesi trying to record a conversation with his mother. And what it really captures, rather than any information because she doesn't give it, is the kind of hesitance and the worry. But something that really stuck with me is when she said, are you going to go and sell me? And I thought, you know what? She's got a point. Because there's an extent to which, you know, writers or people on social media are kind of like taking these experiences perhaps of their parents or people around them, or even perhaps their own trauma, mm-hmm. and they're kind of just pimping it out and selling it. And there's this kind of like compulsion to. So if you had gotten access to your mother's memories and you had written this book as a memoir and gone and sold that, you probably could have also sold that very well, because it's kind of like, I'm taking this vulnerable story, I'm putting myself in it. Do you ever feel like there's this almost like there's this pressure, or we've set up this expectation now that we actually are doing that? We're selling ourselves, we're selling our relatives, we're selling everyone's story, like to chase some kind of publication bug?
That's what writers have always done. Writers have always done that. And this is why people say don't date a writer, because they'll literally just take your entire life and turn it into a novel afterwards. I think that there has to be limits. And I think there usually is limits. You know we talk about oversharing and stuff like that, but I really don't think people online share as much as we think they do. you know, everything is still curated. Even if, you know, when you have a thought and you start tweeting it, no one just blah, 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 and then tweets. They write it and they edit it, then they change it. Like, do you know what I mean? It's still curated in a particular way to try and get engagement, even if it does feel like, you know, it's coming from the heart and all those kind of things. So, you know, yeah, it's,
So this book, Losing the Plot, it has a very specific and unique literary form. But where do you feel that it sits within the kind of scheme of Black British literature? Do you think it sits outside? Do you think there's like a strong literary tradition which it borrows from? What are your kind of influences?
Yeah, it definitely borrows from literary traditions in a sense that the language and the way that I've just, I guess, having the confidence to write Black British slang in a book. That's me pulling from books that I've read, like from Robin Travis to, you know, to Courtney Newland. And then feeling like I can write about an older African woman, you know, that's coming from Buchiem Achata and Sarah Manyinka, you know, reading their books and feeling like, wow, yeah, okay, I have not seen much of this. We need more of this. This is interesting. These, you know, I've always found my mothers and my aunties fascinating. You know, ever since I was younger, I used to just kind of watch them and what they do and find them really interesting. So the fact that there's not loads of literature have them based on it, because anyone who has an immigrant parent as well, you know that they don't realize how funny they are, how interesting they are. Do you know what I mean? So I would love to read more literature about them. But yeah, I'm pulling from everybody, every writer, every Black British writer that's come before me, you know. I also think that, you know, I wish there was more influence. I wish there was more, you know. That's not to say there hasn't been a lot of Black British novels. There has, but, you know, talking to some of the older writers, they will tell you that, you know, the novels from the 70s and a lot of them from the 60s, you're never going to hear about them again. You're never going to see them because they're just gone. They're out of print. People have forgotten their names and those kind of things. So I wish I had more influence, you know. But I am very happy that I can sit here and say most of my writing is influenced by Black British writers as opposed to African-American writers who have had influence on me in a certain way, but not in a way where I feel like, yeah, I'm part of these people. These are my people, you know.
Yeah. And I feel like you've got like a very specific relationship with like a kind of like older generation of Black writers who you've connected with. Do you feel like there's a difference in the kind of like community and support you find with them and with Black British writers that are of your own age or even younger?
I mean I think that may be down to, I mean, it could be many, many things. It could be down to the fact that the publishing industry does position a lot of Black British novelists in a way where it's like we're in competition with each other. It might be the fact that I am a little bit crazy and they don't want anything to do with me. That's one of them. And also might be like the older writers. So for example, like Courtney Newland is my mentor, Benjamin Zephaniah is my mentor. They may have just kind of seen, I don't know, something in me and decided, you know, we want to, you know, try and help him and these kind of things. But yeah, and it does disappoint me, you know, because in terms of Black British novelists, my contemporaries, I don't know any of them. Like I don't have any of their numbers or anything like that. I don't think I'm probably forgetting, but I don't think so.
Why do you think that is? Do you think there's something specific to this time and like the individualism of it?
There's also something very Black British about it. Like, do you know what I mean? Like everybody starts writing and they publish some books, and in a lot of Black British people's heads, they've got that thing where I don't want to be a beg. I don't even think I'm begging or something like that. Do you know what I mean? So it's like, if I reach out to somebody, if I say, oh my God, I love your work, I think you're amazing, blah, blah, I'm suffering from it too. In my head, I'm thinking, oh, he's going to think I'm begging him, man. Do you know what I mean? So I don't want to do it. And I know it works that way as well, which is, it's an annoying thing. Do you know what I mean? I wish we could just, but there are some, I mean, I do see it. I think more with Black British women writers, they don't care about that stuff. They'll reach out and be like, yes, sis, I'm ready. You're like, I want to be your friend. Let me jump in your DMs and let's do our friendship. They're like, yeah, cool. Do you know what I mean? I've never seen a black... Actually, no, some of my queer friends will do that. You know, me and you, we jumped in each other's DMs. Yet to do our friendship.
It's not starting.
Do you know what I mean? So, but yeah, generally it just doesn't happen, unfortunately.
And so you think there's a particular problem with black British men in publishing? Because, you know, there's so few of us anyway.
Yeah, there is. Yeah. I think, that's definitely it. And, you know, we don't talk about it, unfortunately. We have to kind of pretend and create this facade of this, we're all in it together. It's not that we're not hating on each other or whatever. Mm. But I just personally wish that we were more connected. There was more, do you know what I mean? If people were going to talk about this generation, they could talk about this, like, tradition of writers who would come together. Or like there's, like, I can't think of, like, a group photo with all, like, young novelists, young black British novelists in one photo or anything like that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It just feels like everybody's just separate, which I just don't. I wish it was different.
Yeah. So far, you've had a very good review run as well. And I think that sometimes something we've discussed before is the kind of like politics of reviews and, you know, who does the review. So something that people say is that, you know, you don't want your proof to get in the hand of your enemies in case they review someone and decide to go and get revenge on you or something. But at the same time, do you want your proof to get into the hands of, you know, someone who is like your friend and then they review it and they give it something glowing and you're not really sure about the criticism? You've always said that for second books, that's when reviewers really like to let the chopper sing. They like to, you know, say, okay, now that this person's no longer fresh, we can really go to town on this. But your reviews have been really good and beautiful so far. What has been your kind of reaction to this? And have any reviews kind of like stood out to you as being particularly considerate of the book and its themes?
So in answer to the first question, I don't think anybody should be reviewing proofs at all. I think proofs should just be to read for you to get a gist of what's coming. So much changes in the proof, do you know what I mean? Especially if you're writing a book of like poetry or very precise prose and stuff. So much can change from the proof to the hardback. So I don't think people should, they're going to, but I don't think they should. I wish they didn't. In terms of the reviews, I don't know.
You've been reading them though.
I've read all of them. Yeah, I've read all of them. I'm kind of just like, wow, this is cool. I mean, because even with my first book, I think I got maybe like 2 press reviews or anything like that when it first came out. So it's all a bit, it's quite overwhelming, you know. Of course, because I was a lot more precise with this book as well. So I'm reading to see if the reviewers actually read the book or understood it and so on and so forth. So Michael Donkor's review in the iPaper was amazing. And of course, he's another queer black British Ghanaian man. So he read it in a way I hoped another person like him would read it. You know, it was a very generous review. Harriet Mercer's review in the Arts Desk was really detailed and putting out. Oh, you're here. Oh, hello. Hi. Hi. You know, pulling out things that I kind of put in just for fun for myself, you know, but she picked them out, you know, things that, with kind of the smells and the perfume Red Door that my mom and a lot of West African mothers loved as well, wearing Red Door, do you know what I mean? It's kind of like the smell of my childhood, do you know what I mean? So yeah, but yeah, the room it's still very surreal. Like it's hard for me to process. It's the same with kind of like when I won the Desmond Elliott Prize. Even to this day, I won it like 2 years ago and it's still kind of strange to me.
Is there anyone you don't want to read it? Do you ever think, like, do you have an anxiety about particular groups reading it? So say, for example, your mother, do you think your mother would read the book?
She won't read it. I mean, I don't have a problem with her reading it, but she won't read it. I just think she's happy I've done it, you know. She's trying to care. I know she doesn't really care, but she's trying her best. So when we got the hardbacks to the house and I brought them out, I was like, oh, mum, look. She was like, oh, okay. And then she stopped and turned around. She's like, oh, my son, come and give me a hug. Like, because she knew that's what I wanted. She didn't really care. She carried on pounding her fufu afterwards. Do you know what I mean? But no, I don't mind anybody. It's for everybody to read. And again, I don't mind how anybody reads it. If someone wants to read it like a poetry collection or a straightforward novel, or read the, you know, people can read it in any way they want. I don't mind. As long as they feel something from it, that's what I care about.
As someone who's in quite like a niche space of literature, what does success look like to you?
I have no idea. Success.
Do you think there are certain markers of success which Black British authors get quite obsessed with as well?
Yeah. No, I think that a lot of us are too obsessed with being like Sunday Times bestsellers and being a bestseller, is kind of, or being the first. I am the first this, the first that. And we're usually wrong. We're usually not the first this or first that. It's because, again, we've forgotten who's come before us. But for me personally, I would only be able to know success if I was able to live 200 years from now, and that I'm never going to be able to look back and see if my book is still around or people are still taking things from it. That would be success to me, that, 200 years from now, you know, people are still reading it.
And what do you feel is the importance of legacy and posterity to Black British literature? And do you think that Black British books in this moment are aiming for posterity, or are they aiming to kind of capture a viral moment and just sell quickly?
I think it's fairer to say the publishing industry are trying to capture moments and sell quickly. The authors who are being given publishing deals, when you get a publishing deal, you're just so excited. You're willing to like just do what you want to do to, you know, to be successful and whatnot. And I think in the hands of the wrong publisher, it becomes a moment, sell for the moment, do you know what I mean? But let's just aim to be Sunday Times number one bestseller, blah, blah, blah. Do you know what I mean? I think the perfect example of that is Bernardine Evaristo, who's been writing for over 30 years, you know. She wasn't selling loads of books, but her editor had faith in her, was like, no, would you, you know, just keep writing, you know. And then she, you know, she won the Booker. And now her entire backlist has got a revamp, you know, and those books now will definitely be read 100 years from now. Do you know what I mean? And because, she was never thinking about, I wanted to be, you know, a number one Sunday Times bestseller. I don't think that was on her mind at all when she was writing the books. And but I mean, look, each to their own. I mean, you know, we've got to get this money at the end of the day. You know, like, it's difficult to be a writer. Like, you know, some people are not comfortable. Like, I'm very comfortable living with my mom until I'm 50, as long as I can still carry on writing books. I don't mind doing that. As long as she, you know, she's all right with me being there, that's cool. And I'm, you know, I'm still paying for the rent, the gas, the electricity, the water, and everything else. do you know what I mean? I don't mind being there. But other people are like, no, I need to get out. I need to have my own space. I need to do these kind of things. I don't have those kind of ambitions.
And you have the experience, I guess, of moving over to a smaller independent press as well. And do you think there have been like particular benefits to being with an independent publisher?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I mean, Penguin is a massive, massive publisher. And it's the same when you have when you're with an agent who's got a massive roster. You know, it's inevitable that you're not going to be, you know, the gem in their crown. Being with Canongate, which is a big independent press, you know, it's kind of like Faber, big independent press. The experience is different, very, very different, you know. Usually you'll email with your editor about things. No, my editor, Ella, she invited me around the house, you know, she cooked me a vegan meal, and then she was like, we're going to read the book out loud and edit it that way. And that's old school, do you know what I mean? That doesn't happen. When I tell that to people, they're just like, what, really? I just got like one email like about the edits and stuff. And I'm like, oh, I'm sorry, it sucks for you, boy. do you know what I mean? So that experience has been amazing. Yeah, it's been great. And, you know, and when Ella kind of, you know, pitched for the book, you know, she was very honest. And she said to me, she's like, Derek, I love the book, but I'm buying into you as a writer as well. You know, she's like, I want to work with you. I want to develop you as a writer. And Ella's worked with, you know, some greats, you know, Lyndon Kwesi Johnson and people like that. You know, she's been in the game for a long time. You know, she deserves way more flowers than she's getting. So I feel really honored to be able to work with Ella. Canongate, I feel like definitely was the right move for me.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And it feels like you've had a real chemistry with your team to come up with, like, you know, this beautiful book, but also that beautiful cover as well. So I was in a cafe this morning and I had the book and the waitress was like, oh, this book's cover is, you know, incredible. Like, I just wanted to comment on that.
The cover was designed by Emma Eubank, and she actually wrote an amazing breakdown of how she came up with the cover. And it shows like the early stages of how she went through it, how she approached the book, the elements of the book. You know, she really read the book And it's an amazing breakdown of the cover. Yeah, the cover's, yeah, really, really, really good. I love it.
And something I want to ask as well, just going back to the book itself and how you see your kind of like position as a writer, almost like documenting London. So your book is very rooted in Tottenham. Do you see this as being a fixture of your work going forward and you being from that area? Do you feel like you will always kind of like return to Tottenham at its kind of like location?
Yeah, I mean, Tottenham's fun to write about. There's loads of characters in Tottenham. There's loads of, you know, I'm very, you know, it's interesting because, you know, writing these books, I really feel like, so with my first novel, you know, the protagonist, each section is kind of like a prayer to Anansi, which is what's supposed to signify the character reaching for Ghanaian culture, for acceptance. I feel like every single book that I've written and will continue writing is me trying to find some sort of acceptance in Ghanaian culture because I still feel outside of it, you know. And Ghana, I mean, for me anyway, growing up, Tottenham was the hub for Ghana. Broadwater Farm was like Kumasi for me when I was growing up, you know, and that's where we were. So that's why I'm going to write. That's why I just love writing about it. And it doesn't really matter where it's situated. You know, I feel like I'm just writing human stories. Do you know what I mean? I'm writing about people. And yeah, Tottenham's, yeah, it's a place.
And so do you feel that in like imprinting this really strong Ghanaian identity in your writing, you've kind of been able to reconnect or connect more strongly with your heritage and the heritage of your parents?
No, I don't, unfortunately.
So you're just pimping out the culture for the money?
No, but what I'm doing is trying to make people, you know, so in Losing the Plot especially, there's things in there that I think that only a working class British Ghanaian will get. And I did that on purpose so that they would read it and be like, okay, yeah, interesting. Do you know what I mean? Like, do you know what I, and it's just fun to do. It feels like, I don't know, yeah. And at the same time, I'm just entertaining myself too. You know, Ghanaian culture is entertaining for me. I love it. I love everything about it, you know.
Do you ever fear their opinion the most? Because, you know, in case you get something, the tweet slightly wrong, or you get some slight...
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it happened to me, but that reminds me, actually.
Oh, right.
Another Ghanaian author, he's born in Ghana, raised in Ghana, called Nee Parks, actually. He's a good friend of mine, actually. And he was reading it, and he WhatsApped to me. He was like, Derek, here in this sentence, you said that your mum is wearing a kente or something like that. And he was like, no, what you mean? You mean is untuma. He was like, kente is a type of ntoma. And in my head, I was just like, okay, cool. Well, my mom calls everything kente to me. And that's why I wrote that. So I went back to my mom. I was like, mom, why do you call everything kente when this is ntoma and this is a type of ntoma? And she was just like, why do you care about such things? It's none of, like, she was just like, it's none of your business. Do you know what I mean? And so that was worrying. So yeah, when I was going through Losing the Plot, I spoke to my aunties. I spoke to a lot of my aunties. And with words in tree, especially when I'm trying to get the spelling right, sometimes they spell the same word in different ways.
Yeah.
And my mom and aunties haven't been in Ghana for like, what, over 30 years. So my mom would say one way, my auntie would say another. And luckily, I could Instagram this guy who actually lives in Ghana. And I'd be like, yo, my mom says this way, this way. He's like, which one's right? And he was like, they're both wrong. This is how you actually speak. This is the way to do it. So luckily, you know, Kobe Ben, he's actually got a book coming out next year as well. He helped me with a lot of the tree in there.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Yeah, great. Cool. I think we've got time for audience questions now.
Thanks, guys. That was really good. Very cool shades, Jason.
Thank you. I couldn't find my actual glasses.
Yeah, but so. Great questions as well. I think you covered most of mine. But one thing I was going to ask, I think firstly, pick up on your point, I think it's not just a specific West African thing, because as an East African, I find the same problem. I live with my great aunt, and as you said, sometimes she's ready to tell the story, other times you can't get a word out of her. Mm-hmm. So I can relate to that a lot. But I was going to ask, what was the biggest challenge you faced, given that it was fiction and that so a lot of it you could sort of like figure out on your own? What was the biggest challenge that you faced in doing that, because you weren't working from directly the stories that you were being given?
Yeah. I think, so it actually, now, so there was a moment where me knowing I was writing fiction and then also knowing that I was working with inspiration from my mom's voice in my head, that really clashed, because I wanted to write about her romantic relationships, the protagonist's romantic relationships. And I wanted to write about sex, but there was just a part of me that was just like, Derek, like you can't do. And it felt inauthentic to the story I was telling as well, because, you know, if I'm writing about the lack of information and these snapshots that I may have been able to piece together from wherever, sex was never going to be part of that. It would be impossible. I feel like if I put sex in this book, readers would have just been like, nah, I don't think so. This doesn't feel right, you know. And so that was big conflicts where the fiction and I guess the inspiration came and the clashed together, and I had to really kind of, but difficult. I think the hardest part was actually the editing. The editing process was hard. One, because we had to read it out loud. I don't feel like I'm a very strong reader, so I was stumbling a lot with over words. And Ella would say to me, if you're stumbling too much, then maybe it's because you think that the reader knows exactly what's in your head. Do you know what I mean? So that was a really, really long process. It really got to the point when I was editing, I was just like, I don't know if I can do this. I don't know if I can keep going. We're only halfway through the book. And we still had to read it out loud again for a second time as well. I don't know if Ella's here, but I was really pissed off when she was like, let's read it out loud, man. I was just like, I can't believe she's making me do this. So that was probably one of the hardest bits, yeah.
Hi, Derek. Congratulations. Hello. This sounds absolutely beautiful.
Thank you.
I'm really looking forward to reading it. My mum is from Ghana, so I'm going to give her a copy as well. I was actually speaking to her recently, mm-hmm. and as Ghanaian mums do, she just randomly came up with the fact that she's been in the UK longer than she was ever in Ghana. She's actually been in the UK for 50 years compared to her 26 years in Ghana before she came. Mm. And it kind of got us talking, and it made me think about how our generation, as you spoke about, always feels kind of slightly estranged from the culture, and we're always trying to anchor ourselves authentically in that culture. Mm. But having that conversation with my mum made me realise she too is also trying to anchor herself in something she now feels estranged from, even though we would see that generation as authentic. They speak the language, they lived there, they came over. Mm-hmm. So I just wondered how much that came up in the book. Obviously, I haven't had a chance to read it, or you think about that in terms of your own mum.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That conflict is very much there in the book. And I try to, you know, bring it out in kind of really, really minor ways. Like, I'm trying to think, for example, the protagonist in the book will always be eating, I guess, what we call Ghana bread, or Jamaicans call hard dough bread, always be eating the Ghana bread, you know, but with a cup of tea. Do you know what I mean? And those two things clashing together, the two things. So little details like that I tried to put into the book to make it obvious that, you know, and there's also, I've kind of felt as well from like, family and things like that, there is a tiny bit of resentment towards Ghana as well. I'm not sure where that comes from. I do try and interrogate a little bit in the book, but there is a little bit of that where it's kind of like our parents are happy to like build a house in their homeland and do this and put their family in it. But then when you ask them also, when are you going to go and live in that house? They're like, what for?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's weird. It almost feels like they're in a similar situation to us.
Yeah, sometimes I think you understand you're close to them than you realise.
Yes, yes.
Because of that estrangement, even though it's over a different temporality, it's like you're kind of reliving something slightly more distant, but it's the same
thing. It's the same thing, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we're just more willing to talk about it.
Exactly, yeah. Thank you.
Hi there. Thank you very much for the talk. It was lovely. And I look forward to reading the book. I haven't managed to do so yet. One of the things that was interesting to me about... I'm sorry. One of the things that was interesting to me about what you were saying about talking and West African storytelling, I'm from the Caribbean, as may be detectable, is that I have a sense that from my parents who never migrated, they lived in the Caribbean, that storytelling is a huge component of sociality, like you describe. And also I find that Caribbean people in England have continued that. I mean, we're talking in generalizations here. Mm-hmm. But I wonder whether the distinction that you sought to draw, Jason, I think it was you who drew it, between certain kinds of Caribbean experience and storytelling and carrying that on in the West African one, is a question about the specific history of migration to the UK. Because when I think about Windrush and other forms of Caribbean migration, I think that migration, by and large, doesn't occur because there is a domestic conflict, for example, or there is a history of some sort of unrest leading to the to a flight, and maybe the guardedness. I was just wondering as you were talking whether the guardedness that you are describing anecdotally relates to the nature of the migration and also a particular temporal universe, which is different from, say, the 60s and the 70s, et cetera. That's all.
Yeah, no, that's a very, very good point, actually. Yeah, you know, and now that I think about it, you know, speaking to my mum, you know, about, I guess, because when my mum came over to the UK, the president at the time in Ghana was Jerry John Rawlings, who my mum would always say was a wicked man. But she wouldn't talk much about him, you know, and she would always say to me, you know, when she was in Ghana, no one could really say anything about him. And I've read about this. If you say something about him, you know, and he finds out some way, shape or form, you're in trouble. So there might be a bit of that, you know, coming from a place like that where you were told not to speak about, not to speak too much, don't talk too much, you know, keep quiet and things like that. And actually makes me think about, you know, my mom's reaction when I'm in the house and something will happen and I would say, oh, white people out loud. And my mom would be like, shh, why are you saying white people out loud? Someone's going to hear you. And I'm just like, what are you worried about? Do you know what I mean? So there's, yeah, you're right. It's definitely an element of that. That's really interesting. Yeah.
I think you mentioned something about the book, like not being accepted in Ghana or not being kind of taken in to like Ghanaian culture. I just kind of wondered about that impulse, what you were kind of seeking to do that.
No, I mean, I do hope it's embraced by Ghanaian culture. And the book, sorry, what I meant was the book is, me writing the books is me trying to connect with Ghanaian culture. The books are my attempts to do that. But from the people I've spoken to, you know, that I've read it in Ghana, you know, they're very supportive of me as a writer. You know, they seem quite proud of me over here from my debut. And hopefully that continues with this book as well. I haven't yet been able to go over there. Hopefully I will be able to go there next year and see what the reception is like. But no, the books are my personal attempt to really kind of connect with the culture.
Thanks, Derek. Thanks, Jason. I feel like as a Black British man, you could say so much about your life. And obviously, I know this is a work of fiction, but there's so many ideas you probably have in your head. Mm. Was there a specific catalyst that made you think, I want to write about a Ghanaian mother? And also, do you have any ideas in the future as a writer do you want to write in the future? Because there's so much you could say. I feel like,
yeah,
as being Black British, there's so much in the world that we have to kind of deal with.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering what made it now that was important for you to talk about mothers, and is there anything in the future you want to talk about?
Yeah. Yeah, the inspiration for this book came out in 2020 during lockdown, when I guess mortality was on a lot of our minds because so many people were dying, and especially our older relatives, we were thinking about them, and I was thinking about my mum a lot, you know, kind of like what I can do for her and so on and so forth. And I had actually I'd actually retired from writing at the time. I called my agent and was like, I'm done. I don't want to do this anymore. I don't like the industry. I've got no more ideas. You know, so I'm kind of severing ties with you right now. And she was just like, okay, well, you know, in 20 years time, if you got an idea for a book, I'll still be your agent. You know, that's fine. I was like, thank you. 3 weeks later, I was at a friend's house and she was cooking me food. And suddenly, I don't know what happened. It just came over me. I was like, oh my God, like I've got a idea for this book. I've got to write this book. She was mid cooking and I just left. I was like, I've got to write this. I just went home and I just started writing and I just wrote like the beginning of the book, you know, the first few things. And it was fun. I really enjoyed writing them. And I sent them to my agent and she was like, Derek, you know, I honestly think this is some of the best poetry you've written. Keep going. So, and that was that. With Canongate, it's a 2-book deal. And the second book, I think the idea is ready. I'm pretty much going to start writing it whenever. So it's called The Aware Master. So it's literally about the game Aware and about an older Ghanaian alcoholic man who doesn't realize he's an alcoholic, as so many of our fathers don't. And I really wanted to interrogate that as well. So that's what I can say about it at the moment, really. But I don't know when it's going to come out, but I'm due to hand in the final manuscript around 2024, end of 2024. So yeah, we'll see. Thank you.
Hi. How do you go about like writing your new ideas? Like, how do you sort of like go about disciplining yourself, or do you just, is it free writing, or is it what's your
I can't discipline myself when it comes to writing. I wish I could. You know, I really respect writers who say, okay, I'm going to wake up at 7, I'm going to write for 2 hours or write for 5 hours and that's done. I can't do that, unfortunately. Like I said, I just have to just wait for something to feel like, okay, I'm ready to write this, or, you know. And I think that's why I said to my agent, like, I've got no more ideas, because it just felt like there was nothing. So it almost feels like there is an emotional kind of pull that I can pull from. So for example, when I finished writing That Reminds Me, the emotional pull the emotional well that I could pull from was still active. So I started writing again, writing more like kind of poetry, thinking I'm writing something fresh, when realistically I was still pulling from that same, you know, the same well. So it was almost exactly the same as what I'd just written. And then when I realized that, I was like, oh my God, that's it. I've got nothing else left. But then luckily, in the kitchen, that happened again. And with this next novel, that's happened and the inspiration is there. So I'm just very confident I can start writing it whenever I want to. But yeah, I always say this, the idea will come in my head and then I write with my heart. And then I use my head afterwards to kind of shape things. But discipline just doesn't work for me in terms of writing. I wish it did, because I'd probably get a lot more done. But unfortunately, it doesn't.
So kind of across the kind of both books, kind of you can see the kind of form of the writing is as important as the kind of narrative itself. And you kind of were talking about it in that at the beginning. But kind of wondering, at what point in the process does that kind of come in? Do you kind of think of a narrative, and then as you write that, how you're going to tell that through the form comes through? Or when you're conceiving of it at the beginning, you kind of, the structure of the novel is in your in the storytelling when you're coming up with it? Like, kind of what is kind of chronologically when you're coming up with it? How does that all work together?
Yeah, I think it just depends on the emotional state in which I'm writing. It's really hard to explain, and you know, I don't really want to interrogate it too much, because I feel like if I do that, I'll lose it. But it just comes out the way it comes out when I'm writing. You know, things just feel right in certain places, in certain areas. Or, you know, I could write. I think there's like a chapter in the book that's maybe like 2 lines. You know, and I wrote it, and I was just kind of like, that's it. That's all I need to write. You know, that's what it needs to be there. But yeah, in terms of like, yeah, having the voice in the margin, those kind of things were more thought through. Obviously, when I knew what I wanted to do with the sound voice. But in terms of my prose style and the way I write, it just, you know, it just comes out as it comes out, you know. And I've had the question a lot about, I guess, kind of my writing style, and people kind of asking, like, do you think that this is difficult to read and whatnot? But I don't think it is. When I'm writing, I'm always thinking this is accessible to everybody, because the emotions with which I'm writing are accessible to everybody. So that's why my concern is always you know, I don't think you can read any literary novel and understand absolutely everything of it the first time around. It's just not going to happen. So if you read this, and there's going to be cultural references that are just, you're just not going to get them unless you maybe Google or you read a second time. And that's absolutely fine. Do you know what I mean? So I have no problem with people saying, oh, I didn't understand everything the first time round. That's cool. That's good. You know, give it a go the second time. So, but yeah, it mostly it's just kind of an emotional charge and everything just kind of fits together. It's almost like a puzzle sometimes when I'm writing it. Everything just fits together the way it feels it's supposed to.
My question maybe is a bit broad, so kind of broadening the conversation. There's a phrase in your book about your mother living here for 30 years and not feeling British. And my question is about something in the UK making it a place where you live for 30 or 50 years and you still get a question where you're from. Of course, different groups of people experience it differently, but what is in your... Do you see any changes in immigration being embraced in literature, at least? Because, again, English is a language which is spoken by many communities in a different way, but then can you claim ownership of it if you were not born into English or if you have been living here for a long time and you're still being asked where you're from on the basis of your accent or the way you look, this kind of thing. So what's your opinion on these trends, maybe in literature, not the society in general? But
I think for me, I haven't really experienced people kind of in any way trying to pigeonhole my book or ask, is this like Ghanaian literature or, you know, generally people just call me a British writer. They don't even call me a Black British writer. They just call me a British writer. I have no problem with either of those things. But yeah, I mean, look, all language is borrowed. Do you know what I mean? All of it. At the end of the book, when I'm talking about the translations, I'm very clear. And I just literally write, the languages spoken in this book are English and Cree. Everything is an approximation. Nothing is accurate. And that's how I feel about that language. It doesn't belong to anybody. Just some people can wield it in superficial ways to make it feel like, to make you feel like they own that language. But sometimes my mum will turn a phrase in English that really stops me in my tracks. Do you know what I mean? Because she's translating something in Cree in her head and she tried to translate it to English and it's come across so profound, do you know what I mean? That no native English speaker would have been able to turn a phrase like that. So to say that my mom hasn't owned English in that moment is ridiculous to me, do you know what I mean? So I think when it comes to literature and your writing, just don't even concern yourself with those kind of questions. Where am I going to be pigeonholed? I don't think about it at all.
Shall we conclude this part of the evening?
Yes.
thank you all so much for your questions and contributions. It was amazing. I really enjoyed it. And as with the best events here, I forgot to do my job at some points and thought, oh, hang on, I need to be working and keeping me out and stuff because I've been so absorbed. Thank you so much. Derek, Jason, truly, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.